Good afternoon. Welcome to the Wednesday, April 1st meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development, and that's not a joke. So I'll start by opening, at least I don't think it is, I'll start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 383. Jeremy, would you refresh our memory on what this bill is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 permits home care worker who was a party in a Department of Human Services contested case hearing to be represented by a labor union representative. It establishes labor union representative scope of representation. There's no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal impact that's been issued, which shows an indeterminate amount of expense.
And members, we heard this bill the other day. There was no opposition. In fact, the agency testified that they were in support of the bill, and so the only thing that we were waiting for at that point was the fiscal, which we have before us. And so we are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 383 to the floor of the Senate.
With a due pass recommendation? Senator Telfer moves Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And if you could show Senator Przanski as excused, he said he would be a few minutes late, and I will carry this bill.
Sorry, I was reading the fiscal impact statement.
And so the chair will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 383. I think that we'll skip over 2540 for the moment because I believe Senator Przanski has an interest in that bill. And how about if we move to opening a public hearing on House Bill 2201A? Jeremy, tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2201A, it changes the effective date of excluding certain corporate officers' eligibility for unemployment insurance coverage to the first day of either the current calendar quarter or the preceding calendar quarter. It establishes that an officer or employee of a corporation, a member or employee of a limited liability company, or partner or employee of a limited liability partnership who is responsible for fulfilling unemployment obligations for the employer is personally liable for unpaid unemployment insurance taxes in the case of default by the employer. We have a revenue statement of no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal statement which indicates that the measure will have a positive fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. And it looks like we have two witnesses, Tom Byerly and Rob Edwards. Would you both like to come forward? Good afternoon, and welcome back to Commerce Committee. And please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. With me today is Rob Edwards, our tax manager. He'll go over some points of the bill, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions that we can.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rob Edwards. I'm the Unemployment Insurance Tax Manager for the Employment Department. I'm here to tell you a little bit about House Bill 2201A. There's actually two separate pieces to this bill. The first part, as the committee administrator explained, extends the amount of time that a corporate officer can elect out of unemployment insurance tax coverage. That would also eliminate their ability to collect unemployment insurance on those wages, obviously. The second part of the bill extends personal liability for unpaid unemployment insurance taxes to certain members of LLCs, corporate officers, and partners in limited liability partnerships. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for your explanation. Any questions, Senator Telfer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question regarding the responsible party. you know, the IRS has that, but it's only for trust funds. So this is broader than that. This is the entire amounts, interest, penalties. Do we see a legal issue with that?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Telford, no, ma'am. The Department of Revenue currently has this provision for withholding taxes, which, as you state, are trust funds, and several other states have implemented this provision for unemployment insurance taxes, including the states of Washington and California. So, no, we don't anticipate any legal problems.
Follow-up question?
Go ahead.
Just to distinguish, the withholding is, you know, more of a trust fund. These are not trust funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Telford, I would agree with that statement, yes.
Okay.
Okay, other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator George.
Gentlemen, give me an example of a situation that we're talking about where somebody would be personally held responsible. I mean, I can envision a situation where you had a small company, one of the partners takes off with all the dough and leaves the other person holding the bag on that. Mm-hmm. Already massive damage has been done.
Madam Chair, Senator George, the way it would work is that the party who is responsible for failing to pay the taxes through our investigation would be the one who would be held personally liable. So if you had, a corporation with two officers, and one of the officers had no part in deciding, you know, preferring creditors, paying taxes, those sorts of things, they would not be found liable. Only the person who made the decision not to pay the taxes.
Follow up, Manager?
Go ahead.
How do you determine that in a family corporation or in a closely held LLC? How do you ever determine who actually pulled the trigger on that?
Madam Chair, Senator George, we do it by the evidence that's available, such as who are we talking to at the time that the taxes weren't paid, who signed the reports, who had control over the checking and banking. So we basically look at the evidence that's available to us.
One last follow-up, if I could, Madam
Yes,
Chair.
Go ahead.
Can you give me how big of an issue this is in the state right now? Just with so many family firms being under so much stress, and I mean, you do have a corporate shield for a reason. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, without going through bankruptcy, all other debtors are sort of held off by that corporate shield. And I'm trying to figure out why. What the public purpose is of penetrating it. Is this a big problem that we're seeing out there?
Madam Chair, Senator George, it's a problem. We have anecdotal evidence of corporations that have gone out of business and said, we're going to pay the IRS and we're going to pay Department of Revenue because they have corporate officer liability, but we're not going to pay the unemployment insurance taxes. And the result of that is any unpaid UI taxes get pooled to other employers who are still in operation and paying. So we see this as virtually mainly a fairness issue to try and level the playing field.
I'm sure if I could, I'd like to request the agency to give me I don't know if you're planning on moving this today, but just some potential how many cases we're talking about per year. Just that'd be really helpful. I didn't see that in their testimony. Maybe.
Do you have the answer to that today, or is that something you need to do some research on?
You have it.
Madam Chair, we probably need to do some research on it. The fiscal impact does show our estimated revenue, which is the dollars that we think we would collect from this. If you're actually looking for the number of cases, we would have to go back and figure that part out.
Madam Chair, we could do that, too. We could go back and actually calculate the number of cases.
So this sentence that says that you estimate an increase of 321 collections biennially, that's not the same as the number of cases there would be?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, it would be.
Senator George, I think that would be the answer.
Okay.
So, yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Just a whole bunch of things going through my mind, having worked in this area for so long, particularly with responsible party issues. At least the IRS has some criteria that's written out. I would imagine, whether it be by rule, you're going to establish those. I'd like to see what those are. Tax courts are full of arguments on who really is a responsible party. I think it's got to be more than just by the situation at hand. And I, you know, frankly, I'm a little uncomfortable with being able to, by statute, say, we're going to hold you responsible for paying something that, even like I say, the IRS can only do it for trust funds. This is a little far-reaching in my mind. But if I could get something as to how you're going to determine who's the responsible party and what those bullet points might be, that criteria, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Senator, we'd be happy to supply
okay.
that.
Okay, that sounds like we'll then need to carry this over to our next hearing, which we can do since we did have it posted for a work session. So, Pam, we'll carry this over, and I will close the hearing on...
Well, wait.
I'm sorry. I didn't see you. Go ahead, Senator Lennis Anderson.
Well, I noticed that there was opposition on the... At least there must have been opposition because there were several members of the House that voted against it. Tell me what the, do you know what the sense was of, because obviously we don't have anyone to testify against this.
Madam Chair, Senator, all I can tell you is that one of the members at the House committee made a statement about the corporate, piercing the corporate veil, and that mm-hmm. appeared to be the main concern. Other members, I can't tell you what their concerns were.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions?
I do have one
last
question.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, given the fact that this was at the House, was there any legal opinion as to the enforceability of this?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, no, ma'am. There was not.
I might suggest that we ask legal counsel as to what the enforceability of this really would be by piercing the corporate veil.
So you're asking us to request a legislative council opinion, or just,
well, just
ask the question?
Ask the question.
Uh-huh.
Madam Chair, would you like us to ask legislative
council?
That
would be great. I mean, you have your own legal counsel, so I assume that might be a little
whatever
quicker.
You prefer, we could do.
And
that.
They probably have the expertise to.
How about the
do
time?
It pretty quickly. And the time? Yep, there you go.
That's the problem.
Okay. Okay, seeing no further questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2201A, and we will carry this over to our next hearing. Hopefully by then we'll have all the information that we need. And Senator Przanski, you did miss a vote on one bill. Would you like to vote on that bill? That was... the first bill on our list, Senate Bill 383, which passed unanimously.
I'd be glad.
So I'm going to ask unanimous consent that the rules be suspended in order to allow Senator Przanski to vote on Senate Bill 383. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Przanski, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
He votes aye. Okay, motion carries again. And I'll...
Vote for the team.
Good deal.
Yeah. Now, okay, so that's done. So we thought you might be interested in House Bill 2540, so we did not do that one.
Madam Chair, I'm interested in everything you schedule for our committee.
I know you are. And that we bear that in mind. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2540. Jeremy, would you remind us what this bill does?
House Bill 2540 repeals statute designating person or organization engaging services of musician as employer for purposes of unemployment insurance compensation taxes unless written contract between parties designates musician as responsible for required reports and payments. So there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the initial bill. We have two amendments. The dash one amendment declares an emergency and makes the repeal retroactive to October 1st, 2008. And on that, there's no revenue impact and there's a minimal fiscal impact. The dash two amendment simply makes it declares an emergency. And on that one, there's no revenue impact and we have a fiscal minimal impact on the fiscal.
Okay, so members, I'm just going to tell you a couple of things in background. We had some discussion about putting an emergency clause on this bill, which that is what the Dash 2 amendment does, and there was further discussion about making the bill retroactive. When we got into that issue, we really opened a can of worms because it turned out there were some limited cases in which people had actually gotten unemployment benefits under the existing provisions, and that if we went back and undid that part of the law, those people would have then received an overpayment, mm-hmm. which meant that they would then owe that money back. And so that actually became problematic in and of itself. So... So I think what we're really looking at would be either the original bill or the Dash 2 amendment. And I think the department would be fine with either one. So, do we have a fiscal?
Madam Chair.
And we do have a fiscal, and was no fiscal. Yes.
So did you want to have a discussion before we move one of those forward as to where we might be, or did you want a motion?
I think we're ready for a motion.
And I'm willing to make one if no one else was getting up to that.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'd move the Dash 2s be adopted by the committee into House Bill 2540.
Okay, Senator Przanski's moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2540. Is there any discussion on the Dash 2s? Is there any objection? Motion carries. And Senator Przanski.
Madam Chair, I'd go ahead and move the bill as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves the House Bill 2540 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes.
For the record, I think it's important, one, that this be stated that the Dash 2 does provide for the emergency clause, so it will actually allow our intention to be carried out sooner. It also will give guidance to the department so they will not be using more time and energies and efforts in trying to complete something that we would expect to not be moving forward under the current legislation for adoption and for new laws to go in effect. This will give them guidance now and not waiting until January of 2010. And that seems to be, I think, the way that the committee wanted to go, and I understand the agency will follow what we want to. And again, I want to put on the record that that what the agency and the department was doing was carrying out the task, the jobs that were there. And now we've this had an opportunity to reflect on it, and we're asking them to look at a different approach, knowing the new information that we now have, and that this would be a means to expedite it for everybody.
Thank you for your comments. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to put on the record, I almost always vote no on emergency clauses because I think we overuse them in the legislature. I just would say that with these particular amendments, the fact that we're not making it retroactive makes it appropriate, and I just want to clarify why I vote no on emergency clauses. But in this particular situation, I think it's absolutely appropriate to make sure we intercept this issue as soon as possible, especially since we're not making it retroactive.
Thank you for those comments. Any further discussion? Seeing none, did we vote? We did adopt the amendment, right? Okay, so now we're on a motion that the bill go to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. And Pam, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Vice Chair
Telford? Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Senator Przanski, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I'd be honored to. Thank you.
Great. Okay. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2540. And with only one bill remaining, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 821. Hear me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 821 permits collective bargaining unit and public employer to establish a retiree medical trust, voluntary employees beneficiary association, a health reimbursement arrangement, or other health care agreement for health care expenses of employees or retirees. In your packet, we have no revenue impact. We do not have a fiscal yet because it's just scheduled for a public hearing. And in your packet, you do have a letter. You received a letter from Multnomah County in support of the measure. Multnomah County, who already has implemented this, has authority to implement this and send a supporting letter.
Thanks.
And we also just have been handed a statement from a...
That's from the...
That's from you. Okay, great. So it looks like we've got Brian DeLashmit and Brian Goodman.
No, actually, Gerald Gerritsen's going to start. But,
okay.
For the record, Brian DeLashmit, here representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, along with the Oregon State Police Officers Association, commonly referred to as the Troopers Association. Let me give you a very little background, because I think the experts are going to follow me. This issue was brought to me during the interim, post the attempts by both the AOC and the OSPOA to negotiate retirement medical trust for their currently working employees so that they could pay for health care when they retired. As you're well aware, public safety officers often retire at a point where the gap is larger between the time that they retire and the time they're eligible for Medicare. And so one of the largest concerns we're hearing from those that are close to retirement or are retiring is, what do I do with the rising cost of health care? How can I afford that? How can I plan for that? These two bodies, both AOCE and OSPOA, we believe came up with a very innovative idea, which was to negotiate with the state for the establishment of a retirement medical trust in which they would start funding prior to their retirement in this trust account, so that, in fact, they could pay for their own health insurance post-retirement. The advantage of these kinds of plans is that it's pre-tax dollar to the employee, and it also is pre-tax dollar to the employer, because they don't have to pay the payroll tax on it. So it's an advantage for both parties. They engaged in these discussions with the state. The DAS, who negotiates on behalf of the state, came back and said, well, we'll check with DOJ to see if we can do this, what we think is a good idea. DOJ came back with what you see, what I handed out, which was kind of what we believe, kind of a convoluted answer, maybe not fully understanding what we were attempting to do. Summary talks about establishing either in PEB or in PERS, them establishing these kinds of accounts, and that's not what we're talking about. And Daryl and some of the other witnesses will talk about that. But this, the retirement medical trust that they're talking about, is totally outside of government. It's just a mechanism for, out of somebody's paycheck, that money to be going into a trust that's pre-tax dollars that's held aside for them when they do retire. I actually got very excited about the idea when I realized what they were talking about, and in the current economic times, realizing the potential savings not only to the employee of the pre-tax dollar investment in this, but also the pre-tax dollars to the employer and the state in this particular case. And if you could imagine, if we're not paying on whatever amount that's going into there, out of the payroll or out of the check of the individual employee, the state not paying the payroll tax on that, and we did it for all state employees, not just for these two bodies, it could save us hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars. And I think that's important, obviously, in this economic time. So the one additional clarification that I would like to make is that the way this is drafted, and I just became aware of it, you obviously have a letter from Multnomah County supporting this. We were unaware that the language, the way it's drafted, may in fact pick them up. But the AG has never said that they couldn't do that, so many local governments have already done this and love it. The language in the current statute, Section 1, was, however, read by the former AG that the state could not participate in these kinds of things as far as retirement health care for its employees. And so what we're attempting to clarify is that, in fact, they can engage in this kind of a dialogue through collective bargaining, establishing these programs outside of state government, and obviously as a benefit to both parties. And with that, I'll let Daryl kind of give you a description of what he went through in bargaining and with both bodies.
My name is Daryl Gerritsen. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Gerritsen, Goldberg, Fenrick, and Mackler. We specialize in representing public safety independent labor associations. I'll give you a little bit of background. There is a 1988 Court of Appeals case, Oregon State Police Officers Association versus the State of Oregon, where the Court of Appeals held that the then SEB statutes preempted the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, and that therefore a state labor union could not bargain for benefits. They could only bargain for the contribution to the benefits, that would be determined by the board. That is the primary statutory authority the AG relies on to say that any kind of benefit like a retiree medical trust or a VEBA or an HSA or any of the other vehicles that are out there, a state union cannot bargain. Now, that same preemption doctrine does not apply to cities and counties. And as a result, Portland has a VEBA for its police officers. Multnomah County has a VEBA for all of its employees. Clackamas County has a retiree medical trust. Tigard has a VEBA. Tualatin has a VEBA. Beaverton has a VEBA. Hillsboro has a VEBA. Gresham has a VEBA. So they're actually fairly common in public safety contracts where you bargain, generally you bargain that a percentage of your salary will go in, because especially with a VEBA, it has to be a mandatory contribution the way it's structured. All this bill says is that if you're a state and represent state employees, you too can bargain to have a contribution to a VEBA or a retiree medical trust. It doesn't specify that the employer has to set it up. A retiree medical trust can be set up by a labor association. That's how Clackamas County is run. The Clackamas County Peace Officers Association runs there. And it's not a RMT, it's an R something T. And so that's merely what we're after. Public safety officers generally retire in their 50s. Medicare basically doesn't pick up till you're 65, and the cost of health insurance is fairly expensive. In fact, you have several retiree troopers that are here working the Capitol, providing you security. The primary reason they work is so they can make enough money to pay their health insurance. And with that, unless there are any questions.
Any questions for these witnesses, Senator Mona Sanders?
There are three things that I'm very would make sure that there would be something done about. One is, who has oversight over this trust? Who would have oversight regarding audits, or so that it's not misused? The other is, it obviously will get interest. Where, how is that interest used? Does that stay in the program, or can you use that other places? And the transparency of it all. It's extremely important, I feel, for something like this to be transparent, so it could not be abused by whoever. Because we've seen that in local government.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it depends on what you bargain, and it depends on who ends up being the administrator. All this bill does, it doesn't require the program to be set up. All this bill does is say that we're not preempted from negotiating with the state. If we negotiate with the state to establish, say, a VEBA, it could be an off-the-shelf VEBA. There are several insurance companies that provide VEBAs. The structure of a VEBA, for instance, can be either a defined contribution or a defined benefit. Most of the VEBAs, because that's what I'm most familiar with because they're cheaper to establish, most of the VEBAs are much like a 401k with immediate vesting. The employer's creditors can't go back and take the money, and each employee has an individual account. And to the extent they're invested, they're directed like a 401k. Retiree medical trusts generally have a board of trustees. There's a series of reporting that you have to make both to the IRS on your assets. Generally, a true retiree medical trust, the assets or the profit made on the investments goes to the benefit of the trust. And generally, retiree medical trusts are a defined benefit plan. For instance, Clackamas County's, they pay 50% of the employees. When you retire, you get 50% of the employee-only portion of your health insurance paid out of the trust. As far as the financial reporting, that's generally to the beneficiaries of the trust.
Interest.
Well, interest goes to the benefit of the trust in an RMT. That's a defined benefit plan. A defined contribution plan, interest goes to the benefit of the contributor.
Any other questions?
as general rule.
Thank you.
Senator Telford.
Thank you. Just questioning the need for this seemingly enabling statute. What's the obstacle right now from these trusts being established?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the primary obstacle is the Attorney General says the state doesn't have to bargain over it. The problem with SEB or PEB or whatever it's called right now is that PEB, SEB is dominated by the main employee units. The main employee units don't represent public safety. They have much stronger interest in making sure that an affordable medical plan is available to their represented individuals and very little interest in any kind of retiree medical plan being available because most of their people work till 65 and they're Medicare eligible. Our people work till they're 55, they're not Medicare eligible, but we're a minority of the state employees in the grand pool.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, may I point out one additional thing? If you look at the bill, you look at existing statute, and that's the existing statute, it's lines 4 through 7, and you read that sentence, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that, in essence, is what the state used, the AG, in reading that to say, well, we can't even do this. And even though the state was wanting to do this because local government does this and likes it and saves everybody money, but if you read it, it says the state may pay none of the cost of making health benefit coverage available to retired state employees who is eligible, an eligible employee, or to the family members, or may agree to, by collective bargaining, green, or otherwise to pay part or all of the cost. So they hung their hat on this and said, even though we'd like to, this sentence that was put in 1985 doesn't allow us to. But if you look at that sentence, it only talks about the state. It doesn't say anything about local government. So local government's been using the availability of establishing these things for years and years and years. And it was only until these two groups brought forward and said, we'd like to do that too, because it makes a lot of sense, that DAS asked the AG, can we do this? Because we'd like to do this. And they found the statute and said, well, unless you change the statute, we don't think you can. And even though if you set up a retirement medical trust or a VEBA or whatever, in which it was entirely the employee's money, they still believed that the statute would bar them from being able to engage in a dialogue to establish those. And so that's what we're just trying to clarify.
Yes, please. Thank you. I appreciate that. I guess the question then is, do we have any indication as to what the intent of the original statute was, why it specifically excluded this ability?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I've been in this building for 32 years, and each session runs together. I believe this was 1985 when that particular sentence was put in. I could speculate as to why they did that. It may have been because there was some angst about school districts, the state getting the same situation that school districts are in now, in which they were negotiating to pay retirement for retired teachers. We think this is an entirely different situation. In this case, we're talking about the employee out of their paycheck in negotiations with the employer of the state being able to set their own money aside in an account that's a trust so that they can afford health care in their retirement.
So no employer dollars go into this?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, it is a possibility. These accounts, through negotiations, could be that we'll put in a percent, you put in a percent. You know, it could be entirely the employer, it could be entirely the employee.
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Telford, for example, in Beaverton about 4 years ago when they negotiated a cost of living raise, they then agreed that 1% of their cost of living raise would go into their VEBA account. So technically that's employer money, but it was a negotiated raise and then diverted to the account.
And Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the result of that, again, is that the employer, even though they're giving the employee a raise, is not paying payroll tax on that contribution to that, so it actually saves them additional money.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think these kind of programs are brilliant. I really do. And we implemented for our employees Section 125 plan. I noticed there that it says that under Section 125, the biggest problem it's forfeited if our employees don't use it. So I spend a lot of time trying to make sure our employees use it. You talk about this VEBA program, which I'm not familiar with. Is this just available to public institutions? What is the origin of that particular program, and how does that work?
Madam Chair and Senator George, VEBAs are available both in the public or private sector. I think you saw that the auto contracts that GM negotiated about 4 years ago, where they transferred their entire retiree medical to the United Auto Workers and then funded a VEBA account to pay that out. So VEBAs can be established. I'm not sure whether there's a threshold for number of employees. The main thing about VEBAs is they have to be mandatory as far as whatever contribution. You can't have an elective contribution.
Gotcha. Great. Thank you.
Follow up on that?
Yes, go ahead.
So if an employee did not want to contribute, they still would have to because it's in contract?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, correct. That's why, for instance, in Beaverton, when they negotiated their cost of living raise, the 1% that was diverted into the VEBA was then mandatory.
For everybody.
Okay. And the way the regulations are written, a collective bargaining unit can be a group of employees. And if a majority of them vote, then it becomes binding on everybody for a contribution.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony.
And next we'll call Brian Goodman and Ron Lawson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. We do have some pre-written stuff there so you can follow up with. That may answer a lot of your questions in addition. My name is Brian Goodman. I'm a member of the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees and served in various roles. The last was as their president from 2006 to 2008. With me is the past executive VP of the AOCE, Ron Lawson. Mr. Lawson and I were attempting to bargain a retiree medical trust for the membership, but because of ORS 243-252, the AOCE came up short. Officer Lawson and I are here today to educate the need for an amended change to the ORS so that state unions can create their own medical trust fund. The current reading states that the state may pay none of the costs making health benefit plan coverage available to a retired state employee who is an eligible employee and to the family members or may agree by collective bargaining or otherwise to pay part or all of that cost. To us, the language was vague and ambiguous. Again, we did try to get a positive opinion from the AGs, but we weren't successful. About 16 years ago, a sheriff's group in Central California contacted a benefit law attorney and asked about the retiree medical. The primary reason is that employees, law enforcement, could retire at 52 to 55 generally, but their bodies have taken a lot of abuse during their working years. Many could not retire because they had no way to financially fill the gap between retirement and at the time that they would be Medicare qualified. Oregon is the same way. Although we have the opportunity to retire early under the Police and Firefighters Fund, we have no way to gap that bridge. So let me explain what a retiree medical trust is and how it can benefit both the state employee and the state of Oregon. The RMT is like setting up a pension fund, but this is a trust fund, and we can only accomplish this through collective bargaining. Through bargaining, money would be set aside and go directly to that trust. This can be in the form of employer contributions, employee contribution, or a combination of both. But the contributions have to be mandatory. The RMT is like a 457, a deferred comp, or a 401k plan. It's not like, I'm sorry. The contribution is pre-tax, and the trust would be tax-exempt. This trust will provide solely medical benefits when you retire, such as pay for your insurance premiums, dental exams, etc., But during the discussions and negotiations with the Department of Administration Services, GASB was brought up. GASB, or the Governmental Accounting Standards Boards, from 1995 to 2005, has told employers, including Oregon, how to submit and report their finances, including all OPEB, or other post-employment benefits, and this included medical benefits. Employers were concerned about having to report the liability, as it may lower, in our case, the Oregon bond ratings. These liabilities could run up into the millions of dollars and could have decreased bond ratings in our state. In the past, employers did not have to report the obligations, but the RMT fixes this issue. The RMT takes care of the GASB problem because it is a defined contribution and not a defined benefit. As stated before, this is done through collective bargaining at the table. So, for example, if the AOCE were to bargain this, I would have asked for a flat rate of amount, say $100 per member, to be sent to the retiree medical trust. This would take the place of, say, a 2% cost of living adjustment, just, you know, this for this. There's two ways to set up an RMT, an individual or a pooled account. Our position at the time was a pooled account because individual accounts are very complex in nature, and the history of an individual account is that they do run out of money. The AOCE looked at cash, looked at sick leave cash outs to increase an individual's equity into the pooled account to increase the overall payouts. Since 1999, the Portland Police Association has had such a program, but 2 years ago they were moving towards a pooled account. There was a question in regards to the 457, the deferred comp account, and if it could be rolled into the RMT. The answer is no. But however, under the Pension Protection Act passed in August of 2006, public safety employees can move $3,000 through a pension plan into some medical account without being a taxable event. The benefit for the state is that, of course, the state would not pay payroll taxes. This could be a very large savings for the state. If other state unions were to join, and one of the largest issues facing people today is how to fund their medical after retirement. And Senator Anderson, I think this would partially answer your question. The fund would be the responsibility of the unions, but we have also encouraged the state to participate in establishing a board of trustees to establish eligibility rules. In addition, the RMT would have the following: a benefits attorney to draft up the retiree medical trust. They would have a board of advisors. They would have a TPA, or a third-party administrator, an auditor, an accountant, and an actuary. Earnings from the RMT are not taxable since they would only be used for medical payouts. There are two other popular programs out there that were discussed. The VEBA is a Voluntary Employee Beneficiary Association. The VEBA was set up under a 501c9, and essentially you can set up anything that provides a benefit to a member, and it is a defined pension plan, not a defined contribution. The drawback is that it was geared more for active employees and not retired employees. The next one was the ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, was passed to protect employees. This act was a result of the Studebaker Company going bankrupt, as well as other issues. Studebaker had a pension plan that had a 30-year vesting period, but as employees would near retirement, the company would lay these employees off. This act states that employers had to invest in a pension plan after 10 years, but was later reduced to 5 years by the 1986 Tax Act. This plan governs all employer benefit plans, including health plans, except governmental plans. So we are here today to ask that you change the ORS and allow state unions to bargain for retiree medical trust.
Question on that.
Yes.
So you were saying in your testimony that if someone is laid off before they actually retirement age, that according to the contract they could still access this?
That was, I believe, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, that was under the ERISA. That was, it's another it was a different program that was created to protect employees. The RMT is that it is what we were looking at was an initial vesting period of 5 years. irregardless if that individual was laid off, if that person was vested into the RMT.
The 5 years?
Correct.
Okay. I have another question. And according to contract, then, it could be pay part of or all of the insurance. Your premium.
What we were doing, what we were looking at, and this, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, was how the implementation has happened in other states. They would be. The study has shown that upon retirement, the average payout would be four times the amount of the investment per month. This could be through premiums. This could be through doctor visits. The discussion was, well, how do you prove it? Where's the? What about the liabilities? There are ways to set up directly with the insurance companies the premium payout. Other ways would be receipts that would be brought to the trust fund auditor or accountant, and they would be paid out from there.
Okay, thanks. But usually it depends whether they would pay all or part, or is it usually paying all of your that money can be used to pay premiums?
Yes, as long as it's for medical.
All premiums or part of the premiums? It just depends on what they...
Well, I mean, your premium could obviously be higher than what the payout of the RMT is, so they would supplement that portion.
Gotcha.
Of it, yes.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
I guess I can speak now. My name is Ron Lawson. I'm an active member of the Department of Corrections. I work at Oregon State Penitentiary. I'm 58 years old. Basically, I'm looking at another year and a half before retirement, and I'm looking at $700 or $800 a month for insurance premiums when I retire. That's off the top of my retirement. Nobody pays it but me when I retire. So you immediately, upon retirement from any law enforcement, you take a hit. Whatever that is whatever your insurance premium is at the time, unless you work until you're 65 or you're eligible for Medicare or Medicaid. Basically, most of us don't make it that long. The biggest problem that I see right now is if I retire and I die on the normal pretext like most people do in my profession, I'll die within a year and a half or two after I retire. That leaves my wife out there with nothing. She gets $50 more a month out of my retirement when I die. That $50 a month will not cover her insurances. This RMT basically would cover her and myself for the rest of my life. Apparently, I won't be a part of it because I don't have a long enough time left in state government to be a part of it, to be vested in it. But the people that are coming behind me deserve more. Right now in Oregon, we're looking at a lot of financial hardships for a lot of people within any parts of government. You guys are looking at it, we're looking at it, and everybody's running scared. This can save the state a lot of money, and it's a bargainable offense. We can go through and bargain these things in collective bargaining. We've done it before, and we can do it again. I think there should be leaders in this instead of followers.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. And next, I'll call Mary Botkin and Ann Hannes. Good afternoon.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. Ideas such as the Retiree Medical Trust and Voluntary Employee Beneficiary Associations are innovative ideas that have the potential of easing medical costs, burdens for retirees, and taking advantage of federal tax code benefits. AOC is supportive of this bill, and it notes that this is a voluntary agreement. AOC supports fair retirement benefits for county employees at a stable, sustainable, affordable cost to county government. This bill clarifies that counties can do this, and in fact, you've heard that some are already doing so. So with that, we endorse this bill and support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75, and we, too, are here to support the bill.
As you know, and unanticipated medical costs are one of the things, and even anticipated medical costs are one of the things that keep our folks working beyond their retirement age and their inability to continue to pay health care benefits once they're retired. I think, and we believe, that this is a great opportunity to move the state forward in how they're handling pre-tax dollars and offering benefits to employees to take advantage of. We currently do this in the city of Portland. We do it in Multnomah County. And I understand that several of our other local government units do it. I don't have a complete breakdown. I can get you one if you want it. We have a long history of supporting these kinds of programs. It makes a lot of sense. And quite frankly, until AOCE brought this bill forward, we thought the law was pretty clear that you could already do this through the collective bargaining agreement. However, having read 243252 about 20 times, I realized that it's kind of garbled and the sentence makes not much sense. But as a clarifying piece of legislation, we are very supportive of it and think that it makes sense to clarify the current language. You know, I don't know who in 1987 wrote this language, but they didn't do it very well. They clearly did not pass their English grammar test. So we want to thank AOCE for bringing this forward. You know, it makes sense to clarify this language and move this into a position where the state can take advantage of the same programs our local governments are already doing.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And are there any questions? I think you've answered them all, so thank you again. And that completes our sign-up list. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 821? Okay, seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 821. Members, we did not yet have a fiscal, so I assume that we're waiting for that, and we didn't have this posted for a work session today, so I will close the, well, actually, I already closed the public hearing, didn't I? So we're adjourned. Thank you.